This is On the Media. I'm Rick Carr. Every documentary about a musician or episode of VH1's Behind the Music has that shot in it. You know the one I'm talking about. You hear about the band's breakout success while the camera shoots up a music chart and finally rests at their hit song, Number 3 with a Bullet. The chart you're seeing is probably Billboard's iconic Hot 100. It's a monument to stardom that's starting to crumble. That's because it measures radio airplay and record sales when a lot fewer people are listening to radio and buying records than in the early days of the charts. Yes, the Hot 100 does include data from the AOL and Yahoo streaming services, but that makes up just 3% of its data. OTM producer Mark Phillips charts the chart's struggle for relevance in the turbulent music ecosystem.
Billboard created the Hot 100 in 1958 by combining record sales and radio plays to come up with the definitive list of what was popular.
Three Dog Night. They're the hottest act on the charts at the moment. They've got the number one song for the third week in a row. Joy to the World. Jeremiah was
a bullfrog. The charts helped radio stations compose their playlists, and record labels decide which bands deserved expensive promotional campaigns. They factored into how much musicians got paid and influenced young music fans. In other words, charts were a big deal.
There was a sense of, well, these authority figures are telling me that this music is really good, therefore I should check it out.
Greg Kot is a music critic for the Chicago Tribune and author of the book Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music.
In fact, what was going on behind the scenes was simply the payola was flowing in for, you know, a certain single. And that was the record that was going to get played because the radio station saw that as a revenue stream. And I think that genuinely affected chart position.
It was possible back in the day to really buy yourself, if not a number one record, certainly a top 10 record.
Chris Malamphy is the chart columnist at Idolator.com.
Up until the 1990s, Billboard would call or fax retailers and radio program directors and ask them, what are your top sellers this week? What are your most played records this week? And as you can imagine, that system was exceedingly fudgeable.
So fudgeable that Billboard finally did something about it. In 1990, they started using the broadcast data system, which used computers to count how often songs were actually played on the radio. Yes, it didn't stop payola from outright buying plays, but Chris Malamphy says Billboard went one step further with something called SoundScan.
This was accurate counting at the retail counter of the sales of records. So basically when you brought a CD or a cassette to the counter and they scanned the barcode, you were in effect voting for a hit record at that very moment. It was being counted. This changed everything.
Virtually overnight, the charts got a whole lot more accurate, and the effects were huge. Chart columnist Chris Malamphy says the music industry responded to the clearer picture of what was popular by promoting not just underappreciated artists, but whole genres.
The two I would point to most particularly are country and hip-hop. The act that SoundScan arguably made was Garth Brooks. The very first week SoundScan came online, his then-current album, No Fences, shot into the top 10. It's widely perceived that the advent of truly accurate counting allowed the industry to perceive just how popular he was for the first time and promote him accordingly. The thunder rolls and the lightning strikes. After that moment, Garth Brooks never looked back. He spent the rest of the 90s scoring number one album after number one album, not just on the country charts, but on the major pop album chart. He was the best-selling act of the 1990s of any genre. On the hip-hop side, dozens of rap albums that weren't performing all that well on the charts were suddenly massive top 10 successes after SoundScan. Within a couple of months after SoundScan's launch, the gangsta rap group NWA scored their first number one album. Prior to that, they'd never even made the top 30. It's inarguable that SoundScan made it much clearer to the industry that hip-hop was not a fad and that it was worthy of major label promotion.
It was a feedback loop. Knowing what was popular helped the industry make it more popular. And so SoundScan technology was put in more and more record stores. If you buy a record in a store today, there's a 90% chance SoundScan is recording your purchase. But if you're a teenager, chances are you don't buy records in stores. Over 50% didn't even buy one CD last year. Greg Kot.
You know, for a generation, probably two generations now, of consumers, buying a piece of recorded music is really kind of foreign to their way of processing music, you know, and enjoying it and considering it popular. So it's much more difficult to pinpoint, here it is, the number one record in the U.S.
The main album chart, the Billboard 200, does include data from some digital music stores like iTunes. But Chris Malanfi says it's still leaving out a lot of young listeners.
As illegal downloading has taken off, whole chunks of the, shall we call it, underground economy are not getting reflected on the chart week after week. 10 years ago at this time, the kinds of albums that were topping the chart regularly were Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears. But we've started to see some albums topping the charts recently that are beloved by probably a middle-aged audience. I'm thinking of Johnny Cash, Bob Dylan, who scored his first number one album in over 30 years with Modern Times, because who are the last people still going to record stores and buying physical albums? People in their 40s, 50s, 60s.
Right. Okay. The one thing that does skew our measurements is that older people buy more music. They steal less music.
Rob Levine is executive editor at Billboard magazine.
So like, you know, a Bruce Springsteen or a Madonna might overperform on the album sales chart relative to some more subjective measure of their popularity. But as far as like, you know, who's stealing what, I mean, of what use is that?
Well, maybe if the music industry took into account all the different ways music is consumed today, they could have a sound scan-like revelation and start promoting the stuff people really like. But chart columnist Chris Malanfi says they've already tried.
Let's look at OK Go. Here's an act that was succeeding not necessarily illegally, but not entirely traditionally either.
The band OK Go gained fame on YouTube with a clever music video where they danced across six treadmills. It's been watched an astounding 48 million times.
After that viral phenomenon, which wasn't making the industry any money, OK Go's label put more firepower into the band, promoting them more at radio, sending them on tour, all of the things that a record label has it at its disposal to try to make a band bigger.
But it didn't really work. OK Go never became a platinum-level band.
This is what I call the snakes on a plane fallacy. This is really a theory of mine.
Billboard's Rob Levine.
There was a tremendous amount of blog buzz on snakes on a plane. A lot of people said, so many bloggers are talking about this. So many fan sites have sprung up about it. I bet that movie is going to be a big hit. But it wasn't that big a hit. It did okay. And I think what we learned from that is things that people do as a hobby or for free is generally not a very good guide to what they will buy. If I told you that what I eat at a buffet would be a good guide to what I order at a restaurant, you would say, that's crazy.
But I think the reality for a lot of people, a lot of young people, is that the buffet is always open.
Yeah, but I'm not in the buffet business. Our charts are viewed as a more definitive measure of popularity for a good reason. What people spend money on is a very good indication of what they value.
There are a number of different ways to define popularity.
Eric Garland is co-founder of the company Big Champagne, which tries to track all the ways music spreads these days.
And if we're just talking about the breadth of the audience and not the depth of interest, I don't think we're really getting at the value of the music.
Big Champagne tracks legal and illegal downloads, streams on MySpace and YouTube, merchandise sold on tours, and so on. Garland says you need all that information to track the fans' passion.
One of the things that we've looked at for a number of years is something that we call songs per fan. How many songs from this artist is the average fan interested in? You know, an artist like the Dave Matthews Band, if someone is interested in one song, they are likely interested in more than five songs. I chose that example because that's a very elite club. You know, I would put the Beatles in that company. But let me put the question to you. If you look at the top of the airplay charts, the top of the sales charts, how many songs on average do you think people are interested in from those artists? Remember that the number can't fall below one, right? It's about 1.1.
It's a mathematical way of saying the average artist on the top of the charts is a one-hit wonder. And Garland says this effectively chops off the top of the charts, because one-hit wonders don't make money like they used to. In fact, he says they're so expensive to produce and promote that the real money is with smaller acts, with more devoted followings. But how do you measure devotion?
An artist has to have the tool set to be able to tap into this real-time conversation that's taking place and engage their fan base.
Duncan Freeman is the founder of a website called Bandmetrics, which he plans to launch next year. He showed me how it works by plugging in my band's name. Yes, I play in a band. In one section, a Google map popped up that showed where we're getting radio plays. Another section located the cities where we're getting the most buzz and mapped a potential tour route for us. And then, using natural language processing, Freeman hopes to track Facebook, Twitter, and other social networking sites so bands can effectively identify their biggest fans. You know, the ones who buy things from them.
So we look at fans in essentially four levels. We look at the casual listener that may listen to one or two of your songs. Then there's the fan who listens to your music and they go to a show. The next level up would be the supporter. And these are the folks that are out there talking about your music and who are willing to bring two or three people to see your show when you come to town. And then the highest level, which we call the superfan, these are your evangelists.
The website looks less like a music chart and more like the tools of a web-savvy political campaign. And maybe that's what the chart of the future needs to be, a tool for organizing communities. If it works, it would transform and replace the whole idea of charts. Instead of being a list for the record execs of the top-selling artists, it would be a list for the musicians themselves, of their most devoted fans. Kind of cool. Only problem, it just doesn't make a good radio show.
You're tuned to Britain's grooviest radio show, Top of the Pops.
For On the Media, I'm Mark Phillips.
North London, called The Kinks. And it's called The Strange Effect.
Got this strange effect on me, and I like it.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper, with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.